content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello and welcome to Heard Any Good Books Lately? A program from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm George Douglas. This program is brought to you by the Friends of the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped, an organization of citizens, volunteers, and patrons, all interested in supporting the library and the services it provides. The Friends Group was founded in 1989 and now has more than 300 members across North Carolina. If you'd like to join the Friends Group yourself, we'll have information on how to do that later in this program. This program is all about books, with special emphasis on those available from the North Carolina Library for the Blind. The library has more than 86,000 titles in its collection. Books and magazines are available in large print, braille, and talking books as well. Now, the library has more than 11,000 patrons across the state, and if you're not a patron but are interested in becoming one, I'll have more information at the end of this program about that as well. This month, we'll take a look at some of the most popular books checked out during the month of September 2017 at the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. The first book we're going to talk about today is called Brush of Wings by Karen Kingsbury. From the number one New York Times bestselling author Karen Kingsbury comes the third novel in the unforgettable Angels Walking series about divine intervention and the trials and triumphs of life for a group of friends. Despite needing a heart transplant and against the advice of her doctor, Mary Catherine moves to Uganda to work at a brand new orphanage there. Whatever time she has left, Mary Catherine wants to spend it helping children, especially since there will be no children of her own. The only problem is Major League Baseball player Marcus Dillinger, the man she never meant to fall in love with. Neither Marcus nor Mary Catherine's other friends, Tyler Ames and Sammy Dawson, know just how serious her heart condition is. Still, Marcus is sure in the depths of his soul that something isn't right. Ultimately, his correspondence with Mary Catherine leads him on a desperate life-or-death mission to rescue her and get her to a U.S. hospital before time runs out. Meanwhile, Sammy and Tyler struggle with issues of their own. In a season when Tyler plans to ask Sammy to marry him, the very core of their relationship is in jeopardy. The team of angels walking is busier than ever in this epic battle between life and death. A Brush of Wings is a poignant tale of love, sacrifice, and the power of faith. Again, the book is called Brush of Wings by Karen Kingsbury. Now we'll turn to a name that's one of the giants in the publishing business these days. This book is called Missing, a Private Novel, by James Patterson. Who else, huh? Missing is, in a word, terrific. It is part of James Patterson's ever-expanding private series, which concerns the world's largest private security and information agency, and is set in Australia around the private Sydney headquarters. Catherine Fox, Patterson's co-author, is one of Australia's most critically acclaimed and commercially popular mystery novelists, and many of the books in her Anya Crichton series are available in the United States in various formats. These should be snapped up immediately and read. If her work in Missing is any indication of the quality of her writing, and this is a one-sit, fast-paced read that fully satisfies but nonetheless will leave you wanting more. This book is told primarily from the first-person viewpoint of Craig Gisto, the head of Private Sydney. Now, we meet Gisto on the 8th anniversary of the worst day of his life, when his wife and young son were killed in an automobile accident. In an illustration that the universe is not cruel, but rather merely indifferent, Gisto receives no respite to reflect on the tragedies of the past. He arrives at Private's offices to discover that the exterior has been vandalized and their computers are down. Now, the clients waiting for him in his office are difficult and make a request that skirt the borders of legality. And Jack Morgan, Private's head honcho, has asked him to look into the suspicious disappearance of Eric Moss, the enigmatic CEO of a nonprofit named Contigo Valley. Now, it is the latter case that propels a great deal of what occurs in this book, in Missing. Moss has gone missing after abruptly resigning from the company, which is valued in the billions of dollars, which is not bad for a nonprofit, and known throughout the world. Morgan is a longtime friend of Moss and his daughter Eliza, who herself runs a high-profile company called Shine Management. Moss's abrupt resignation is highly uncharacteristic of the man, as is his method of doing so. An email notice when he eschewed most forms of technological communication. Private gets going on its investigation, but soon discovers that background information on Moss is almost entirely non-existent. Now, it is also of interest that practically everything Eliza knows about her father is wrong. Meanwhile, remember those clients who were waiting in Gisto's office? Well, they wanted a background check on a potential surrogate mother. Gisto reluctantly agreed to do so, but soon regretted that decision when the surrogate turned up brutally murdered and the infant in her care disappeared. And the couple who requested the vetting, they are in the wind as if they never existed. Gisto needs to find them and the baby before it's too late. The baby, of course, is at risk, and Private's reputation will soon be in tatters otherwise. Then things get worse. Missing moves. Patterson's trademark short chapters are on display and in abundance, and he and Fox demonstrate their storytelling ability at warp speed. American readers may experience a bump or two when encountering Australian geography and or slang, but for the most part, the book gives off a Southern California vibe, even though it's set in and around Sydney, Australia. This latest for the U.S. installment in the Private franchise should attract new readers to the series and hopefully to Fox as well. And that was a review that was written by Joe Hartlob. Again, the book is called Missing, a Private Novel by James Patterson. Another review. This time we're going to turn to the book called Below the Belt by Stuart Woods. Stone Barrington and his latest love, Holly Barker, have just landed in Santa Fe. They are seeking some alone time when suddenly the phone rings. It's Will Lee. Stone is a good friend of the former president and his wife, the current president, Kate Lee, who is also Holly's boss. Will invites them to the opera, and Stone accepts. When Stone and Holly arrive at the location to which they've been invited, Stone is stopped by a Secret Service man who escorts him to an SUV parked not far from the house. Will is waiting for him and has a story to tell. Years ago, Kate was the deputy director for intelligence at the CIA. She reveals that a man named Ed Rawls, who was a CIA mole for the Russians, went to prison. Will pardoned him after he had served 7 years. Before Will ran for president, Kate had a meeting with Ed, who told her that the man who dropped out of the race for his second presidential term, Joe Adams, was in the early stages of Alzheimer's disease. Nobody else knew except for Ed. Joe had picked Will to make the run. Will's story is a long one. One part of it is the revelation that while Ed was in prison, he wrote an account of his years at the agency, including the end of his career and how he surreptitiously helped Kate's campaign. Well, what he wrote is explosive information that cannot be released to the public. It is a book written from memory in prison. He gives Joe the manuscript and all the backup documents and computer disks. Joe and his wife want the material out of their house. Joe appears to believe that some of Ed's revelations might hurt Will's legacy and interfere with Kate's reelection. Will tells Stone that he must pick up the package that very night. He gives Stone the address, and this starts the propulsion of suspense. Stone arrives at the Adams house, and before he knows it, he is handcuffed to a suitcase with a long chain. Joe will not reveal what the case contains, but Stone agrees to put it in his safe. Soon, Stone meets with Ed, who tells him that the package is his insurance against the wrong people getting a hold of the wrong case. The suspense continues until a murder is committed. Stuart Woods can always be depended upon to deliver a page-turner, and Below the Belt, the name of this book, certainly fits into that category. His characters are limed with a strong hand, and the plot is attention-getting. And that was reviewed by Barbara Lipkin-Gershenbaum in this year, in 2017, Below the Belt, by Stuart Woods. Another book by Stuart Woods right now, we had a couple during the month of September that were extremely popular at the Library for the Blind. This is called Fast and Loose, and this is a new Stone Barrington novel as well, and it's a product of Stuart Woods' own background with sailing and powered sea vessels. Now, he is an experienced sailor, having enjoyed the sport for years, with time in competition even. Now, Woods has concocted a unique way to introduce Stone Barrington to Dr. Paul Carlson and his daughter, Marissa, also a physician. Their larger boat, more expansive and expensive yacht has collided with Stone's boat, leaving his at the bottom of the water. He discovers that his rescuers are owner-founders of the world-famous Carlson Clinic, with a reputation akin to the Mayo Clinic. Later, over dinner at his place, Stone is informed that the Carlsons will reimburse him for the loss of his yacht with an elaborate replacement. He quickly bonds both intellectually and sexually with the charming Marissa. The relationship takes off at a rapid pace, and she reminds him often that her Swedish background is a liberal one in the relationship realm. Well, Fast and Loose would be but a soupy love story were it not for a complication that develops between a client of Stone's law firm and his newfound friends. St. Clair Enterprises, the client company, has suffered the loss of its CEO and owner, Christian St. Clair, to a bomb blast. Stone had represented the owner of the locked case that eventually ended up in St. Clair's hands, ending his life. The St. Clair Company, now run by his successor, Eric Mocker, is active in property acquisition, management, and sales, accumulating millions in profit from its ventures. Dr. Carlson contacts Stone for help when Mocker's company moves to buy out his medical business. The doctors have been generous with employees for years, allowing for stock acquisitions in the corporation. If the owner employees can be persuaded to invest their holdings in ownership, the takeover can be avoided. The situation appears simple enough, but Mocker puts his ruthless techniques to work early on. Not only has Mocker assumed management of St. Clair as CEO, he has acquired the entire personal, financial, and property items owned by St. Clair, except the amounts left to the dead man's wife in the will, which was presented to the company's board of directors as proof of Mocker as beneficiary. Well, Mocker begins an assault on the Carlsons with a phony news item about Legionnaire's disease found in their hospital. The scare should drive patients away from treatment, which would allow him to step in with a low-ball offer to scoop up the business. However, Mocker underestimates the tenacity of Stone and his good friends Dino Bacchetti, New York City's police chief, and Ed Rawls, the purveyor of underground news. events spin toward Mocker's death spiral with fast and loose intensity. The man's deviant behavior escalates from one near miss to the next with no apparent ending. The Carlson Clinic ownership becomes an obsession that drives him to commit multiple crimes. Meanwhile, Stone's relationship with Marissa remains fast and loose as well, although she continues to give out the message that she is a true Swede, liberal in love matters. Stone feels a comfort with her approaching a deeper level. In past novels, his romantic trysts have come nowhere near the love shared with his late wife. This time, though, he visualizes what a future might look like if he were married again. Fast and Loose lives up to its title in raw action, complications, and educational information about luxury yachts. Pretty interesting. Stone's exploits hardly resemble those of an average American attorney, and Woods gives his fans a magic carpet adventure ride. That sounds like a good one. He has written a lot of books, that's for sure. Fast and Loose by Stuart Woods. And you're listening to Heard Any Good Books Lately, a regular program from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm George Douglas. Thanks for joining me today. Now we're going to turn to another book, and this one is by Nora Roberts. It is called Island of Glass, the final Guardians trilogy novel from the number one New York Times bestselling author of Bay of Sighs and Stars of Fortune. Perhaps you have read or listened to one of those. As the hunt for the Star of Ice leads the six Guardians to Ireland, Doyle the Immortal must face his tragic past. 3 centuries ago, he closed off his heart, yet his warrior spirit is still drawn to the wild. And there's no one more familiar with the wild than Riley and the wolf within her. An archaeologist, Riley is no stranger to the coast of Clare. But now she finds herself on unsure footing, targeted by the dark goddess who wants more than the stars, more than the blood of the Guardians. While searching through Irish history for clues that will lead them to the final star and the mysterious Island of Glass, Riley must fight her practical nature and admit her sudden attraction to Doyle is more than just a fling, for it is his strength that will sustain her and give her the power to run towards love and save them all. The book is called Island of Glass, and the author is very popular, Nora Roberts. Now, another big name in the publishing business. This is a writer who comes out with one or two great books every year. Of course, you recognize the name, John Grisham. And this is a book called The Whistler, which I think was the big book from last year. Well, that was one of the most popular books at the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped during the month of September in 2017. So here goes. Over a publishing career spanning more than 3 decades, John Grisham refuses to allow his writing to be pigeonholed into one distinct style. While his novels almost always are legal-themed, they cover a wide range of subjects and quite often are based on contemporary legal issues such as the death penalty, wrongful convictions, tort reform, and the influence of money in judicial elections. Occasionally, he wanders far from the law with local flavor or sports-themed novels. He has also written 6 children's books. Unlike many of his contemporaries, Grisham refuses to settle into a formulaic pattern with recurring characters and formats. Each of his books is unique and is a new, enjoyable, and scintillating reading experience. Now, in The Whistler, the one we're talking about right now, Grisham has returned to a style reminiscent of his first successful novel, The Firm. Remember that one? He has written a straight-up mystery thriller that, although legal-themed, has little legal substance in its plot and structure. Granted, the central villain of the story is a Florida judge, and her bête noire is Lacey Stoltz, an attorney and investigator for the Florida Board of Judicial Conduct, assigned to review allegations of judicial misconduct. But the legal underpinning of the plot ends there, as there are no courtroom battles between lawyers and judges, just regular investigations that could be undertaken by anyone in law enforcement. This background is not offered as criticism, says the reviewer here, but Grisham writes a good basic mystery story. His hook is the law, just as other mystery writers use horses, English country manners, or street cops as theirs. It is the writing and the solving, not the genre, that make the mystery enjoyable. Well, Stoltz and her partner, Hugo Hatch, are experienced investigators. Their careers have taught them that most allegations against judges involve incompetence rather than corruption. When a previously disbarred attorney suggests to them that a Florida judge is deeply ensnared in a massive corruption case, allowing her to steal more money than anyone can imagine, they are skeptical. But the allegations do have some substance. The judge, Claudia McDover, has assisted influential members of her community in the building of an Indian reservation casino in her judicial circuit. Favorable rulings and lawsuits, both civil and criminal, have been rewarded by huge cash kickbacks to this judge. The disbarred attorney, now using the name Greg Myers, has a confidential source providing him with information on Judge McDover's activities. In addition to her financial windfall, the judge aided a criminal prosecution in which a resident of the Indian community who led the opposition to the casino was falsely accused and convicted of a double homicide. Why not just contact law enforcement officials, asked Stoltz. Myers, a convicted felon, does not trust law enforcement. More importantly, he has a larger motive. Under Florida law, if the corruption is exposed, he and his associates stand to gain a large financial reward as whistleblowers. Well, Stoltz agrees to open and pursue an investigation, the subjects of which soon become aware that their finances and activities are both under scrutiny. Some, being the criminals they are, react with violence, but Grisham, unlike other writers, does not resort to gun violence, car chases, or superhero exploits by his characters. They are dogged investigators finding piece after piece of a complex puzzle. At times, the story moves very slowly, but as more pieces of the puzzle make the crime picture clear, Grisham moves to a rapid conclusion. The final 100 pages will hold your attention until the very end. John Grisham has written 29 legal-themed novels. His followers may find this latest effort a little light on the law, but it is a fast-paced and well-plotted mystery that has a message for its readers. His themes and characters are always entertaining and thoughtful. The Whistler is no exception, and that review was written by Stuart Schiffman. The Whistler by John Grisham. Another book that was very popular during the month of September at the North Carolina Library for the Blind was One of the Bookshots by James Patterson. I've read several of these on this program, and maybe you're familiar with these. They're called by Patterson lightning-fast stories, novels that you can devour in a few hours and virtually impossible to stop reading. And all of them are original content from James Patterson. But the book that was most popular in September in this category was called French Kiss, a Detective Luke Moncrief Mystery by James Patterson. And the simple summary here is, "Bonjour, detective. Now watch your back." Very handsome and charming French detective Luke Moncrief joined the NYPD, the New York Police Department, for a fresh start. But someone wants to make his first big case his last. Welcome to New York, monsieur. And that is called French Kiss, a Detective Luke Moncrief Mystery by James Patterson. That sounds like a good one. If you have not read or listened to one of those, it's a great story, and you can completely devour it, whether you're reading or listening to it, in a couple of hours. They're really a lot of fun. They're pretty inexpensive to buy, but of course you can get it from the library, and it doesn't cost you anything. Let's look at another book now. This is called Echoes in Death by J.D. Robb. There's been an uptick of interest in the in-death series for reasons not particularly germane to our purposes here. Those who have been following these excellent genre-blurring novels by J.D. Robb for any length of time can be assured that nothing of import to readers has changed with the publication of Echoes in Death. Robb continues the practice of her plot alchemy, combining elements of romance, mystery, thriller, and speculative fiction to carry on the tradition that has resulted in one of the most unique and readable series available. Echoes in Death opens on a bone-chilling New York night in February of 2061, when the lives of very different people are seconds away from intersecting. New York Lieutenant Eve Dallas is returning with her billionaire husband, Rourke, the rogue-turned-business and real estate impresario, from a charity gala when a bleeding and naked woman stumbles, grievously wounded, in front of their vehicle. Well, Eve and Rourke come to her aid and transport her to a hospital. The victim is quickly identified as Daphne Straza, the wife of Dr. Anthony Straza. The couple heads over to the Straza residence, where they find the doctor, who has been brutally beaten, tortured, and murdered. The Strazas had just finished hosting a dinner party, and it appears that an intruder bent upon a burglary robbery had been lying in wait for them. It quickly becomes obvious, though, that the damage inflicted on both of the Strazas goes far beyond a simple heist. There is something personal about the attacks. Eve learns in due course that Anthony was regarded as a highly skilled physician, but that his social skills did not quite match his medical ones. An examination of the premises yields the conclusion that Anthony was cold and controlling, qualities that extended into his relationship with his wife, who was some two decades his junior. Given the extent of Daphne's injuries, it is quite clear that she was not his killer. Well, Eve begins her investigation into the murder and assault on a series of fronts, aided by mid-21st century technology familiar to our time, but just a touch or two fancier. And, of course, Rourke, whose wealth and connections give him the ability to ferret out information otherwise unavailable, even to the police. Peabody, Eve's investigated partner, is also along for the investigation and remains over the top in her enthusiasm for all things that are. Well, for all things, period, though she ultimately proves to be an invaluable source in one way or another. The resulting story is a whodunit in its most basic sense. The doctor was not well liked by any means, but dislike does not necessarily give rise to murder. No, there's another factor here, and Eve's canny instinct wins the day in a story that gives new meaning to the classic term, crime of passion. Echoes in Death by J.D. Robb. And that's all the time we have for this month's edition of Heard Any Good Books Lately? I'm George Douglas. I hope you enjoyed it. If you'd like more information about how to become a patron of the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped, simply Google or search North Carolina Library for the Blind or call toll-free 1-888-388-2468. You can also use the same numbers and website to join the Friends of the North Carolina Library for Blind and Physically Handicapped. It's that organization that sponsors this monthly feature on books. This program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Heard Any Good Books Lately? Will be available right after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time.